Welcome to New Human Living Radio Show, bringing you powerful interviews to awaken the power in you. Learn more at newhumanliving.com. And now your host, Les Jensen.
Hello and welcome to the show. Thank you for joining us here on New Human Living Radio. It's such a beautiful day in Boulder, Colorado. I'm very excited for the show tonight. I wanted to start off with a talk about the topic of money. And, you know, when I was preparing for the show tonight, I always sit still and listen, and the topic I need to talk about comes to me. And money was a curious one tonight because it so often the topic that comes matches the guest, but and maybe I'm going to learn how better later on in the show, but I wanted to go ahead and honor that inspiration of talking about money, because money is a very powerful symbol in our society today. Money is an attribute of so many aspects of our life. And the curious part of how we experience money is that it is a single symbol. It's not a group of symbols. It's a single symbol. We have this iconic representation of money. And money decides so many things about our lives. If you think about the kind of car you drive, where you live, what kind of vacations you take, what kind of opportunities you feel you can, quote, afford, unquote. In every one of those choices, there's that dollar sign symbol, that symbol of, can I afford it? Can I financially afford this situation or this opportunity? And the power of money is so curious in that it's so decisive. Since it's a single symbol, and in the United States, it's the American dollar, the value of the American dollar is decided by so many variables. It is decided based on so many variables that you yourself, you the individual, can have an idea of what you want to do with your money, and yet the value of the money is changing as you hold it in your hands. You can have a particular amount of money in a bank account, a fixed number over time, and the raw value, which is a perception, the value of money is a perception, is an idea that we've agreed on. The value of that fixed amount of money can change over time. We're watching now how more and more people are homeless, and there's more and more homes that have been foreclosed on. And the common element behind that is money. The homeless people don't have money to afford housing. Or people could not sustain the payment of money to keep their housing. And during the week, while I was thinking about this, I came across a quote by Thomas Jefferson, and he made this quote in 1802. And I find it spot on accurate for what we're living in our life today. The quote goes, "I believe that banking institutions are more dangerous to our liberties than standing armies. If the American people ever allow private banks to control the issue of their currency, first by inflation, then by deflation, the banks and corporations that will grow up around the banks will deprive the people of all property until their children wake up homeless on the continent their fathers conquered." Now, I don't want to create any idea of fear. I don't want to create any idea of worry, because every one of us is an extremely powerful soul having a human experience. But what I do want to do is create a cognitive awareness of the mechanism of entrapment and enslavement that is based on our monetary system. So when choices come before us, when choices become before you and me, we can make choices that expand our liberties and return us to freedom. So when we talk about the notion of money, in the early 30s, by the act of passing a law, the Federal Reserve was created. And that created a national bank that is a private company. If you go to Washington, D.C. and you look up government offices, the Federal Reserve will not be under it because it's a private office. So what Thomas Jefferson talked about became a national condition. The Federal Reserve became a national bank, and it didn't exist before the early 1930s. And with this banking system, I have to laugh because people, the news will say, well, the chairman of the Federal Reserve was asked to do a financial forecast of the economy. And I have to, you know, it sounds like going to the mobsters of a town saying, well, how much extortion and embezzlement do you think you're going to get away with in the next few years? It's like asking the Federal Reserve to give a comment about the nature of the economy is laughable because they're the scallywags that are leveraging all of the financial transactions in the United States. And so to ask them what the forecast is laughable. If before the Federal Reserve was created, the monetary system was a function of the government, and so the government could not be in debt to a private institution. And now we have this idea that the government is in debt X amount of trillions of dollars. And I say, to who? Who could stand up and say, well, it's me. I am the one. You all are entitled to pay me. And when we start to put a clean set of eyes on it, you can start to understand how the leverage of debt is really paralyzing the ability of people to truly live in freedom. So say you want to go buy a home. You're going to go into a bank and you're going to say, I want to borrow some money. And they're going to take 15, 20 minutes, fill out a spreadsheet or whatever, and they're going to give you a loan. And this loan came out of thin air. The value of money is an intellectual property. There's nothing specific behind it except the value that we give it. And so there was no effort to create the value of money. It was an agreed upon attribute of this symbol we call money. So when they give you that loan, I make a mortgage payment and I look at how much interest I pay every month. The bank didn't labor 30 years to give me that money. They didn't labor at all. It was a creation of the people. And yet myself, a human, I have this seemingly obligation to pay the interest to the bank for something they did not labor to create. There was no effort on their behalf to create the loan, yet I will work these years of my life to pay off the, quote, interest, unquote. And if they do this over the span of millions of Americans, then with very little effort, there is an enslavement of debt. The idea of debt has no high vibration to it at all. Whenever you go to consider something, you can get a general idea of whether it's good or bad based on the feeling or the intuitive hit you get off of it. And then I watch the stock market, and I find that money, the value of money as it relates to a company, is really a very detrimental attribute of our financial system. So when you create a company, and let's consider a company based on the value to human beings, human value. So say your company provides comfort to senior citizens or to disabled veterans, or the human value of the company is the reason you created the company. Your heart is living in a space of compassion for a company. And then you bring that company public with an IPO, initial public offering. Once your company is on the stock market, it no longer becomes about the human value. It no longer becomes based on the human value that you're providing. Once your company becomes public, it is observed and judged and rated by other people's opinion of the monetary value of your company. So the value of your stock is an ideology. It's based on the perception of value, monetary value, not human value, monetary value that your company is providing, and it's based on how that compares with all the other companies on the stock market. You know, in television, it takes a lot of money to build transmitters and studios and cameras and switchers. And when a station decides to upgrade their studios, they can spend millions of dollars. And when you compare one television station to another, both stations are going to need to upgrade. And so the expense of upgrading is equalized as it's compared from one television station to another. But once I go on to a public stock market, and then I tell my board of directors that I have to spend millions of dollars to upgrade my studio, and there's not an immediate return on the money, that devalues the worth of my stock. And so I can't compete with my peers. I compete with the big money makers, the Googles, the Microsofts. And the value of my stock is compared to non-similar industries. And so any expenses I have, by its very nature, devalues my company. So the reason I give these examples is we have set up our financial system where it very easily undermines and diminishes the value of substantial human compassion expressed as a corporation. And I bring up these examples so you can understand. Make your own choices, make your own conclusions, but there's a fundamental devaluation of our human experience based on our financial system. So that's all I need to say about that. I think in the future, the money system that we have will be balanced when we don't have a monetary consideration. It's all based on human value, the passion of our soul. There's got to be thousands of different models, if not more, of how our economy could be based, and we've basically tried one. So whenever there's a new idea that comes out that suggests replacing the single monetary system, for example, Bitcoin. Bitcoin came under heavy scrutiny by the Federal Reserve. Imagine that. There was some other player in the field looking to take a cut of their their sandbox, and they became critical of it and created a dialogue of fear based around the new currency. So as we go through into the future and bills and laws are presented and congressmen and politicians running for office are debated, keep in mind that until we return to valuing our human experience above any symbol or monetary exchange, then we're really not truly, genuinely free, and we're not free of being put in debt or entrapment, if you will, by others. Well, that's enough about that. You know, it's for me, it's a real privilege to have this radio show because of the wonderful people I meet. And our guest tonight is just one of those people. Donna Visaki knows a great deal about connecting with spirit and awakening to greater possibilities. Every one of us is a soul here on this planet, and our souls have no limitations, and our souls have no fear whatsoever. And to awaken to the greater idea of what our life can be always expands our choices and our experiences of our life. So I'd like you to join me in welcoming Donna to the show. Welcome to the show, Donna.
Thank you very much, Les. It's good to be here.
So you're going to talk about opening to possibilities by awakening and raising our consciousness. Do you want to tell us about how that came into your life as a passion of yours?
Well, my journey began in 2003. My daughter was killed in a car accident, and she was my catalyst to start searching for answers. You know, first it's the questions of why and why did this happen to me and where is my daughter and what happens when we die and things like that. And then it's been, you know, 11 years now, and over that time I've grown and expanded and learned so much. And it's just been a fascinating journey that there's way more to life on this planet than what we, you know, our 3D brains think there is.
Sure. Well, to survive the loss of a child, especially unexpectedly, that's got to rattle your cage pretty deep. I mean, turn your world inside out. It's hard to imagine that kind of an event. How did you get through something like that?
Well, it takes a long time. It's not something that you get over right away. And my journey really began a couple months after Christy died. I went to a Compassionate Friends meeting for parents who've lost children. And a woman came up to me afterwards, and she said, "Your daughter was standing behind you all night long, and she's a beautiful girl." And this woman was a psychic medium. And she handed me her card. It said Angel Reader on it, and she invited me to come see her. And, you know, of course, I had no experience with mediums or psychics or anything, and this was a totally kind of foreign thing to me. But you're so desperate to connect with your loved one, with your child, and you'll do almost anything. And so it took me about a month to get up the courage to go see her. But when I did, you know, I was able to connect with Christy and talk to her. And at first, you know, your questions are like, well, how do I know this is my daughter, you know, or are you just making this up? But she identified things like Christy had a dolphin tattoo on her shoulder. And she identified, things like that this woman wouldn't know. So I knew that she was legit and everything. And so I started, I started reading all the How to Talk to Dead People books by psychics like James von Prague and Sylvia Boylan.
Sure.
And, and books on connecting to your angels and things like that. And then I was at, and I'd spend hours at Barnes & Noble, you know, going through all the books in the New Age section and that. And one day, Conversations with God by Neil Donald Walsh jumped off the shelf at me. And I swear that book just opened up my eyes in so many ways, and it was like, oh my God, this is what I've been kind of ruminating, these thoughts and ideas and stuff been ruminating in the back of my head, and that just makes so much sense. And I spent a lot of time, you know, trying to connect with my daughter and make sense of everything. But along the way, like I said, I learned and experienced and grew in so many, many ways. It's been a fascinating journey, and it's not easy. You know, there's so much grief and pain in losing a child and losing a loved one, and it takes a long time to work through that, and it never really, really leaves. There is light at the end of the tunnel, and you do survive, and you can keep moving forward. And I met with two friends of mine who also both lost children today, and my one friend said, she said, I am happier now than I was before my son died. Not that I don't miss him terribly, not that it wasn't, you know, one of the most horrible things that ever happened to me, but it really opened up my understanding of the world and of the universe and of spirituality and of who I am. I wouldn't have had that if this hadn't happened to me.
Yeah, I can speak about my mother passing. I was a young husband with a family, and my mom died of cancer, and it really tormented me. I mean, for weeks, I was just crying, and, you know, an old friend would call, and just the name of my old friend, you know, it's Kelly on the phone or something, and I would just drop right back into torment. And I remember having a dream one night, and we were all gathered around my mother. All my siblings were gathered around my mother who had just passed. And my hand was on her leg, and she picked up my hand and squoze it to tell me she loved me, but she put it back on my leg as to say, you need to get on with your life. And just to have that connection with her in that moment, in that dream, it was so it was so her in her persona and the feeling of her skin and everything. And after that dream, I had a sense of comfort. And you know, to lose a loved one like that, it can really put you on the spot, if you will. Well,
right.
So the ideas of angels and spirits beyond death, those weren't really new to you, were they?
It wasn't part of my arena. You know, I just never really thought about it you know, I went to church and I believed in God and heaven and all of those traditional kinds of perspectives about, you know, what happens when we die and that, but the thought that, you know, our loved ones can connect with us. You know, when you talked about the dream and that, one of the ways for them to reach out to us is through our dreams, because our defenses are down. You know, we don't have our regular monkey mind going, telling us this isn't real and things like that, and they come to us in dreams. And they have many ways of reaching out to us to let us know that they are around and they're with us and they're helping us. And I have to tell you, I have three amazing grandchildren, and they see, they always see Christy. it's fascinating to talk to them because I don't see like they do. And I think the kids, you know, so many children, you know, there's stories about they have imaginary friends and things like that. Well, they're not imaginary, they're real.
Yeah.
They still see these people who have passed on. They still can interact with them. And my grandson, this is my son's little boy, he was 6 when Christy died, and he and Christy were buddies, and he would always see her. And I didn't want him to think that it was weird, and so we would talk about it, you know, and I'd ask him every once in a while, well, have you seen Christy lately? You know, what's she up to? And things like that. And even, you know, over the years, when he was 9, I remember he was he would walk home from school, and he would be home alone for about an hour until his dad, my son, got home. And I asked him one day, I said, so have you seen Christy lately? And he said, she sits on the couch with me after school until my dad gets home.
How nice.
And he sees her. And then later on in that school year, I asked him again, you know, have you seen Christy lately? Does she still sit with you after school? And he said, yeah. He said, but sometimes I think I see her at school. And sometimes when I'm having trouble with my math, she'll whisper the answer in my ear. She'll go, 25. And my husband and I said, you are in big trouble because Christy sucked at math. But they do. He has a younger brother who's always seen, you know, Christy. And then my other daughter had a little girl about a year after Christy died, and she sees Christy. And then a couple of years ago, my sister passed away, and she was really close with my grandchildren. They see her all the time. She just shows up. But like I said, I don't see like they do, but they see so clearly. It's like looking at you or me.
Sure.
It's fascinating.
Yeah. Well, and I totally understand what you're saying, because I'm the same way. I don't see with that clarity that so many people have. But do you have a feeling of it? For example, I don't ever see, like, I shouldn't say ever, because I don't want to limit myself, but I typically feel, and for such a long time, I wanted to see, damn it. I wanted to hear.
Yes.
I wanted to be crystal clear. Just give me the instructions. I'll go do it, and that'll be that. And it's like, sorry, you're a feeler. And I'm like, I'm a feeler. How do you write, you know, feelers don't have pictures, you know, or whatever.
Yeah.
I'm
a feeler too.
But
yeah.
I just started trusting it. I just started trusting it, even though I didn't have a overwhelming sense of it. I started to trust it. And the more I did that, the better I got at understanding the feeling. Did you find that once you accepted the fact that you're a feeler,
yeah,
and not a seer, did your ability to interpret the feelings improve?
They did. And I also hear. I hear Christy talks to me. I have other guides and angels. This is one thing that I've learned over the years, is how to connect with my guides and angels and that. And they talk to me. And then I feel the energy. I feel it in my hands. I feel it in my body. I can, you know, but I don't. Sometimes I see things in my mind's eye, but mostly when I really get into meditating or something, my grandkids see. But it took a while, you know. Again, I think it's a process of allowing it and not fighting it.
Yeah.
And paying attention to what it what it looks like. But I do hear now, and I hear pretty clearly. I wrote a book about a year ago. It took me 10 years to write this book, and it was basically my journey and a lot of the things that I've learned along the way in that. But the pieces would come in, you know, at odd times. I'd be, you know, 4 o'clock in the morning, all of a sudden, you know, I'd get this information. It's like, I got to write this down, you know. Or I'd be standing in the shower and I'd get this information coming in and it's like, please let me remember this by the time I get out of my shower and into at my desk, you know. And or I'd go for a walk and stuff would come in that. So I'm starting to hear much better. And I think, again, it's just being open to it.
Sure.
And trusting it. That's the biggest piece, I think, is learning to trust what you're getting and know that it's coming from your higher self or from your guides or angels or whatever you want to call it, and learning to, you know, believe that it works.
Yeah. It's starting to trust, putting weight on that trust. And,
mm-hmm.
Well, you mentioned your book. What's the name of the book?
It's called I'll Meet You at the Base of the Mountain. And the story behind it is about a year after Christy died, I met another psychic medium. Her name is Kimmy Rose, and she's from Michigan. And I was at a conference, and she was there, and we just clicked. And then she went home, and I went home, and she sends me an email, and she said, Christy came in to me today, and she has a message for you. She said she'll meet you at the base of the mountain. And she went on to describe this big, lush, green mountain and this river running by it and everything. And I said, Kimmy, I don't know where that is. And then a year later, Kimmy came to Fort Collins, and she was doing a gallery reading, you know, with a lot of people there, and she was calling on people in the audience, doing psychic readings. And she said, Donna, she said, Christy's here, and she has a message for you. And she says, she'll meet you at the base of the mountain. And she goes on to describe this big, lush, green mountain again, the same message. And I said, Kimmy, you told me that a year ago, and I still don't know where it is. And I felt like this past, you know, 10, 11 years, I have been searching for that mountain, searching for Christy, trying to connect with her, working with, I started a business. I've worked with a lot of different amazing speakers and teachers and things, and I've traveled and, obviously we're in Colorado. Every time I'm at a different mountain, it's like, is this a mountain, Christy? Is this where you're going to connect with me? Or I was in, you know, I'm in Vancouver or I'm in Seattle or I'm in Hawaii, and I'm constantly looking for Christy and for this mountain. And so this story is, again, my journey. First, it's very raw in the beginning. It's my emotions and all of the things that I experience. And then, it gets better. I talked to my brother-in-law the other day who said he hadn't read it yet because he couldn't get past the first couple chapters because it was so raw and filled with emotion. And I said, it gets better. You know, it gets easier.
Right.
As it gets easier for me. And I just talked to him. He says, I finally read your book, you know. But he said I couldn't get past the first chapters initially because it was so hard. But that's what, you know, that's what it's like when you experience, you know, something like this. We all have so many amazing challenges in our life at times, and it is very, very painful. And so I wanted to express that. I wanted people to feel that. And then to be able to move past it and to see the light at the end of the tunnel. And I'm not going to tell you how it ends and whether I found the mountain and where Christy was and that, because you have to read the book to find out.
That's right. Well, you know, you bring up a good point. I mean, you talk about the rawness of those feelings. And sometimes that rawness can be so overwhelming that people push those feelings away. And, you know, like when you see behavior like addiction or lashing out or
mm-hmm.
or something like that, a lot of times it's to quell, to suppress, to distract us from deep, raw feelings within our own psyche. And those feelings are there to tell us how we see ourselves in the situation. And you know, for him to start to read your book and then stop because of the rawness of the feelings, when our feelings paralyze us, it can be overwhelming. But I liked what you said, that when you go through the feelings, when you allow yourself the space to feel the rawness of the feelings, then they release and you become free of them. But if you don't ever get through them, they wait for you, you know?
Yeah. Well, and it, like I said, it took me 10 years to write this, so I'm really good at stuffing my feelings, compensating through by working. The first week after Christy died, I could not sit in my house and be alone with my feelings. And so I bury them, and I go to work, and I keep busy, and I do all this stuff and everything. And it did. It took me 10 years to write this and to bring those feelings out. And it was such a release for me to let that go finally. And, it, you know, there's some of it is still there. I'm tearing up now as I talk about this. But it was like walking through a door and letting that all of that emotion and all of that heartache and everything, letting it go when I finally wrote the book and poured all of that out into my book. It was a cathartic for me.
Wow. I would imagine when people read the rawness of your story, the rawness of their story that they haven't identified in their psyche would be stirred. And what a compassionate thing to do, to allow yourself to be so raw and vulnerable with something so public as a book. It's very brave of you, and that's very bold of you to be able to sincerely share that, the heartache and the despair and the rawness of such an event. I mean, congratulations. You're going to continue to touch people at a very deep level because you gave yourself permission to convey that rawness.
Yeah, and it, like I said, it took time, and I think that's the piece with grief and loss, is that it's not an occurrence that happens and then you deal with it and then you're done with it, and it takes a long time, and it comes up. I remember over the years, and I wrote about some of these experiences that you think, yeah, you know, I've dealt with that, I'm good, and then something comes up. It might be a song or a remembrance about your child or your loved one or something, and all of a sudden it's like you're dropped into that pit again. And then, you know, you got to feel all of that all over again. But what I found is that over the years, that the pit wasn't as deep, and you didn't stay down there as long, and it was easier to come out. And the periods in between, you know, hitting one of those drop-offs again got further and further apart. Like I said, it's a journey. But it is important, I think, that you feel those emotions and don't stuff them, which is, like I said, I'm really good at that. But it was important, and it was important to write it out. And I get a lot of letters from people who can resonate with different pieces of the book, and especially, you know, people who have lost a child or a loved one. But also that there's other parts of it, you know, of my story and the things that I've experienced. And one of the things that I've learned is when I first started, you know, on this journey, and I started to recognize signs and messages from Christy and get those kinds of things starting to come in, and that I would tell these stories to people, and about, oh, this happened and that happened and blah 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 blah, sharing all this information. And I felt like people were at first, I'd have lunch with one of my girlfriends or something, and I'd be telling this stuff, and I felt at first like they were patronizing me. Oh, she lost her daughter, you know, we'll listen to her story. But the more we talked, what I found was that everybody has a story. They have some unexplainable thing that happened to them that they don't tell anybody about, they don't talk about, because people are going to think it's weird. But they can share it then. They start sharing with me, and by the time we're done with lunch, they're sharing their stories. And that was the thing, number one thing I learned, is that by sharing these experiences that happen to us, it gives other people permission to share theirs. Because, like I said, we all have them, but we don't want to go there.
Sure. Oh, you bet. You know, my father was a World War II vet, and he had – I saw pictures of him before he went to war, and he was this smiling, happy country kid. He wore overalls. He had this big smile on his face. And then every picture after the war, he had this scowl on his face. And I wasn't born till after the war. And he was a very intense man in my life. He cut you in half with his look. He had an immense amount of anger. And when he got angry, everybody in the household tried to become invisible. Nobody wanted to be the receptor of that anger. And when he passed, it was really a curious thing, because when he passed, I connected with him, and he was this brilliant, gorgeous, soft, loving light. Mm. And I'm like, how the hell did you fit in such a beautiful, elegant soul fit into such a tyrant of a body? And I understood then that it was his calling. He was the fire that tempered me. It's like he challenged every aspect of who I thought I was at such a root, fundamental level in my life, that I would develop a quest at a very early age to understand the truth of who I was. And while he was alive, he was a tyrant. But once he passed, he was a very sweet and loving soul. And that dichotomy really kind of wrestled in my mind. But then I understood that some of my most profound life lessons within my own life came from who he was as a human being, even though as a soul he was just an immensely beautiful being. Things aren't always as they seem until you get a bigger picture, you know.
I think you're right. You know, and I remember a story that I read somewhere about a man who was, he was like the black sheep of the family. And he was the alcoholic and a bum, and all of the rest of his brothers and sisters went on to, you know, they went to college and they had good jobs and very respectable citizens and everything. And here's this one, you know, guy who was the black sheep of the family. And somehow it was through a medium or something that they were able to, you know, get a picture of the bigger picture in that. And the family had a genetic history of alcoholism. And this man, this soul, took on the role of taking on the alcoholism for the family, because he was the strongest soul to stop it, so that the rest of the family, the rest of the siblings, could move forward without that, carrying that gene, that habit, whatever, forward.
Right.
So he's like this powerful, powerful, beautiful angel soul that took on this role, you know. But we don't see that. All we see is the, you know, the drunk. And
right.
So we don't know.
I think a lot of times when we look at the news and there's these, you know, I always take the label of the villain and shift it one step left or right to lose the emotional reaction to it. So I call them scallywags or scoundrels. but the scallywags that are jacking our society around and challenging us to wake up are really very powerful people trying to wake up powerful people like ourselves. And in the eye of God, or if you will, all of it is permissible. And it's these scallywags that are thumping on us with all these incongruencies, with these deceit and whatever, trying to get us to awaken ourselves. And in truth, mm-hmm. when we all go home, we come from the same fabric, from the same
right.
oneness. And so it's the story that we're living out collectively. Well, you know,
right.
it really takes courage to follow your gut or your intuitive voice. And you've started this, you've written a book, and I understand you bought a magazine and you began Bella Spark. That's a pretty bold move. Do you want to tell us about how that happened and what it is today?
Well, I, after Christy died and I started reading all of these books and things like that and learning all of this new information, and it was like, well, I want to see these people. I want to hear these people. And I live in Fort Collins, Colorado, and nobody ever came here. I was the executive director of the symphony at the time, and I've always done events and that, and I thought, I want them to come to Fort Collins. Nobody comes to Fort Collins. So I decided to bring somebody in. I managed to talk Sonia Choquette, who's a wonderful intuitive, to come to Fort Collins and speak, and promoted it, and we had 500 people there. And it
nice.
Told me that there's other people like me who are searching for answers, who want to hear this message and that. So I started bringing in more speakers, and then finally, I have to tell you, I was meditating, trying to meditate regularly, and somebody had told me, take 10 deep breaths and then ask the angels, what is it I need to know today? And so I would be doing this kind of regularly every morning, and I'm not hearing anything or getting any kind of messages and going, I don't know how to meditate. I can't do this. Well, then one morning I'm doing it and I hear loud and clear in my head that this voice that says, quit your job. And I'm going, great. You know, the first time I start hearing voices and they're telling me to quit my job, you know, what's my husband going to say? But I realized that it was time for me to do this and that I needed to follow this path. And so I started Bella Spark Productions, and I started doing events with different speakers. I've worked with Deepak Chopra and Wayne Dyer and James Van Praagh and Greg Braden and all these amazing, amazing visionaries, and learned so much over the years. And then somewhere along the way, I bought this magazine that was a local publication in Fort Collins. I still ask myself, why did I do this? But it felt like, you know, this was exactly what I was supposed to do. And our tagline for Bella Spark is Igniting Change. And it felt like I'm planting seeds. My goal, my vision is all just about to bring this awareness to people, to provide opportunities to hear these different speakers or to read articles and things like that to people in the community and around the globe and that who might not know about this stuff or who are searching for this kind of information and that. So I've been doing this for about 8 years, and it's been a fascinating journey. You know, you were talking about the whole money thing, you know, it's interesting because, you know, we're so tied into the monetary system and how things operate. When I started this, I thought, what have I got to lose? If I lose my house, it's just a house. But I go many times, check that, X that. I didn't really mean that. You know, I don't really want to lose my house here. So that's too has been, you know, part of my journey is to, you know, bring this message to other people. But as I wrote in my book, you know, as I look it back on my journey and I figure, well, you know, it was all about me. It was all about everything that I needed to learn, and the people that I worked with were all the people that I needed to learn from.
Sure.
You know, everybody else got to come along for the ride maybe, but the journey, you know, it was all about
yeah.
me.
Yeah, nice. Well, you talk about the first time you hear your angel clearly, they tell you to quit your job. I mean, maybe not the first time, but when you consider the notion of angels that are there to help you, and I mean, if our listeners don't really give much thought day in and day out to the idea that they have angels, how would you recommend somebody initiating or starting to have a dialogue or relationship with angels? Because we all have them, and as they typically don't engage anything unless you ask them to. I like to keep mine busy. No slackers, you know, slackers in the back. If you don't like my joke, step aside, you know.
Well, and I don't know exactly how. I mean, I like I said, I share my stories and hope that somebody maybe can take something from that, because I have many of them of experiences, and I always say, you know, so many of us grew up, you know, in Christian households. We went to church and that, and we read the Bible, and there's all these stories about angels and God talked to Moses and Noah and so on and so forth. And I'm going like, what, did God just stop talking to us? They're still there. And
sure.
We just need to listen. You know, we just need to be open and allow and be open to the possibility that there's something more. And then they will start showing up. And there are signs everywhere. And we're getting little nudges and we're getting signs. And they're trying to connect with us. They're trying to help us and to show us the way. And we walk around with blinders, you know. It's and I do this too. And then every once in a while I like, oh, my God, there's a sign. It's so clear. It's in my face. How could I miss it?
Right.
So that's what I ask for. I like you, I ask for, I want it clear, I want it concise, tell me exactly what, you know, I'm supposed to do. And I ask for confirmation sometimes. Sometimes I get, you know, I'll get a message and I'm going, is that what I'm really supposed to do? So I have two very, very intuitive friends, and I will say, if I'm supposed to do this, my friend Marguerite will call me by noon today. And she will. You know,
right.
she'll go, I just felt like, you know, I needed to call you or something. And I'll go, thank you for being my confirmation. She told me I wasn't supposed to give out her number because she said I'd spend half my day just, you know, being confirmation for people and calling them. But
right.
I asked for confirmation, and you can. You know, if you're not quite sure, say, okay, I need another sign. I usually like this. Say three times, I want to hear something three times. I have to tell you one of my stories. I started doing speaker events in the speaker series. I called it the Extraordinary People Series in Fort Collins. And then I decided to expand to Seattle. And so I set up a series of events starting in January of 2008 in Seattle. And I'm having lunch with two new women I had met who were both psychics. And we're having lunch, and we're talking about our businesses and how we want to grow and things like that. And I said, well, I'm starting this new series in Seattle in January of 2008, and I'm thinking in 2009 I want to add another city, and I'm thinking somewhere in the Midwest. And then we're just eating and talking and everything. And all of a sudden, this one gal pipes up and she says, you know you're going to Vancouver next, don't you? You might think you're going to the Midwest, but you're going to Vancouver next. Well,
oh,
I'd
nice.
Never even been to, I'd never even been to Vancouver. I wasn't even sure where it was. And I thought, okay, I'll just kind of put that in my back pocket under the crazy psychic file or something, you know. And this was December 30th. I remember the date. It was December 30th of 2007. So the next day is New Year's Eve. and I wake up with the stomach flu. And I spend the whole day either in the bathroom or in bed, you know, and I'm laying in bed and really rueful that I'm not going out to dinner that night. And the phone rings, and a woman's on the other line, and she calls about the speakers that I'm bringing to Seattle. And she's this chatty Kathy, and, you know, I'm laying in bed. I got nothing else to do, so we're just talking away and everything. And she's so excited, and she says, I can't wait to see these people. I'm coming down for every one. I said, well, where do you live? Vancouver.
Nice.
You know, I hung up the phone, and I said, okay, I guess I'm going to Vancouver next.
Right,
and
yeah.
She did come down for everyone, and we got to be friends, and she became my partner in Vancouver. So the next city I went to was Vancouver. But I got Vancouver the first day, Vancouver the second day. It's like, okay, I get it.
Right,
usually
right.
I asked for three times, but I got that one after two. You know?
Well, and,
so we
and
do
you were
get
open.
Messages.
You're open to it, you know? And,
yeah.
And a lot of times when we stay in our mind, we just stay in this monologue thought process, and we don't open up to that inspiration of spirit. Well, you know, time flies by pretty fast, so I want to make sure that people know how they can get your book or subscribe to Bella Spark, or if they so desire to donate to Christie's Memorial Fund. Do you want to tell us about that?
Okay. Well, my book is available on Amazon. It's called I'll Meet You at the Base of the Mountain. And there's more information on my website, bellaspark.com. You'll find all the upcoming events that we have. We have some amazing events. We have Lee Harris, who's a channel, going to be in Fort Collins next Thursday. Panache Desai is coming to Fort Collins in October. He's going to be doing an evening lecture and then a full-day workshop. This man is amazing. He's a beautiful, beautiful soul. And then we have John Holland, a psychic medium, wonderful friend of mine. He's going to be doing two events, one in Fort Collins and one in Denver in November. And then Dr. Sue Mortar, who's a wonderful, delightful speaker and teacher, is going to be here in February. So I've got events on my website. A magazine is on the website. You can read it online, or you can. There's a location to subscribe. We'd love to mail it to you if you like to read your magazine like me, soaking in the bathtub. And you mentioned Christie's Fund, and we started a foundation shortly after Christie died called the Christie Vasaki Memorial Foundation, and we do a huge golf tournament every year, and we just had that. We had two big events last weekend, and we've given out scholarships and supported a lot of programs for youth and community programs in that. And last year when we started it, we kicked off a campaign to build a house for Habitat for Humanity. And so we've been raised, we had to raise $100,000. And we were able to
Well, I think we lost our caller. Sometimes we have technical problems. So, Donna, it was so nice having you on the show. We were out of time anyway. Thank you so much for sharing your story and your passion. I really appreciate it. You know, we all are souls here having a human experience, and our soul has no idea of limitation, and our soul has no idea of fear. And it's our humanness, it's our ego, it's our little self that gets separated from that connection to source. And it's our little self, our ego, that can get carried away with our life, trying to manage it, trying to run it from a kind of a mechanical point of view. And when you learn how to slow down the mind and soften the ego so your heart and your soul can have a more prominent place in your everyday life. Bigger ideas come into your life, bigger ideas come into your story, and the possibilities of your life expands. And life gets really exciting when that happens. So we're out of time, and I'm glad you joined us and listened, and we'll check you next time. Thanks for listening.
This has been a New Human Living radio broadcast. You can raise your own personal power with Personal Power Fundamentals Home Study Course at newhumanliving.com. Thanks for listening.
This is Les. I see you dropped off. Well, I'm so glad. No, actually, we were right at the end, and it was perfect because everything you said about your book and your webpage and everything got on the show. So the only thing left was the formal goodbye. So that worked out real well.
Well, me too. I mean, you know, my soul is looking out. transmitters, a huge amount of power happens. And it took me a long time. It took me years and years of contemplation to understand the nature of the television transmitter power. And at the same time in my life, I would be going through these emotional upheavals. And I would notice that an immense amount of power would come out of my subconscious as an emotion and flood my being with feeling, you know? And so my guess is to language the nature of human power and how we lose it to our karma and how we can get it back. Karma is the tendency to have a repetitive pattern or nature to our being, kind of a karmic momentum. Our karma is stored in our subconscious as unexpressed feelings and mentally as beliefs or thoughts. Like the belief that the money system is the only thing that will work, that's karmic. Consequence, because all the other options are not available if you believe that this stays so in them, but the karmic consequence. And then spiritually, your relationship with God is a karmic experience. If you're a peasant and the church is the only people with a red phone to God, then you're disconnected from God, and God can't talk to you. And so spiritually, you've been ambushed and disconnected from your own personal connection with God. And so those are three real simple ideas of how karma can be imprinted in a psyche. But you can undo all of that, and that's the journey home, the journey back to the light. And so I language the nature of personal power from a Western point of view, the nature of karma from a Western point of view. So it's much more palatable and understandable with the Western mind. So if you're looking for a speaker sometime, I'd love to share what my soul has taught me about the nature of our human experience. I do the same thing too. I do the same thing too. I say, well, that's interesting. I'll listen to my guidance. And so I have no expectation of it'll be what it needs to be, and I don't need it to be a particular way. Sure. But it takes a little bit of a dance to, you know, your ego's got to trust it to really let go. And I find that when you get inspiration from your heart, the quicker you act on it without rationalizing it with your mind, then it's like a muscle that the more you flex it, the stronger it becomes. And then your heart can inspire you moment by moment by moment, and your mind doesn't have to drive the boat. Well, thanks for being on the show. I really appreciate it. shut her down,